Hi, my name is Amanda Morehouse and I'm from Clearly Training. And over the next session of this AAT podcast, I'm going to be looking at three key areas to help address managing finance teams through change and uncertainty. But before we get into that, I'd like you to grab a pen and some paper to enable you to jot down some of the ideas and suggestions I'm going to be giving you over the next 20 or so minutes. I'm sure you can do that, can't you? So why do finance professionals need to be able to manage change? Well, think about it. What's your value to your organisation? Are you paid to keep things the same as they've always been? Or are you now expected to improve processes, enhance service, and change fundamentally the way that your organisations and businesses run? It's ironic, isn't it, that the only thing that is certain is the need for change. And why is this the case in 2010? Well, I call it the three C's. We've got clients and customers whose expectations are getting higher and higher. The second is that we are working in a very competitive marketplace. And therefore, if we don't change the way that our businesses run and the way that finance add value, it's likely that there's the risk that our competitors will do that before us. The third C is that of computers, and computers are driving and enabling us to change at a faster rate. Technology is very much an enabler. It doesn't actually give a business benefit in itself, but it helps us to do things in different ways. So, why should anyone want to be led by you? Because at the end of the day, finance teams are changed. They are motivated to change, usually through the intervention of one manager and a conversation with a manager. So can you think of a person who has motivated you to want to make some changes in your finance department? What is it that you saw them doing? What did you hear them saying? And how did they make you feel? Because if we can engage with finance professionals so that they want to make changes, that things will become so much easier for you as a finance manager. So back to that question, why should anyone want to be led by you? So now that you've had some time to think about it, what is it that you bring to the finance team? It's not what the finance team can do for you, but of course what you can do for your finance team. And if we want to engage people, then we have to behave in a way that they want to be led by us. So what are the key characteristics? And I'd like you to write them down on that piece of paper of why should people want to be led by you. Now, very recently, I was watching The Godfather 2, and one thing that I heard Al Pacino say of one thing that he'd learned from his father, Marlon Brando, is the key thing is to see things through the other person's perspective and to get to know the other person's perspective and to anticipate it. And essentially, in this question, why should anyone want to be led by you? It's understanding the other person's perspective and perception of the world. And the first thing that I'd be asking you to do is to think about who are your key stakeholders, the people that you really need to influence to be able to make changes and to manage people through change. And stakeholders are groups of people with similar interests and similar levels of power. Stakeholders are groups of people with similar interests and similar levels of power in influencing whether your change in the finance department is going to be a success or not. So if we can put ourselves in the shoes of our stakeholders and see things through their eyes, this is going to enable us to anticipate what the different levels of resistance may be, or perhaps what the different levels of concerns are going to be. In also looking at our stakeholders, it's anticipating what changes we need them to implement. And is it physical changes in processes and systems, or is it in their values and beliefs? Now, looking at these stakeholder groups, they are going to have different levels of power and interest over the success in which we implement changes. And it's good to be able to group them and to prioritise which stakeholders are going to have a higher impact. These are what I call our key players, high level of interest and high degree of power. And if we were thinking of the amount of time that we need to allocate in our change plan to ensure that we engage this group, these are the people that are going to need most of the time as far as communicating, engaging, and motivating to get them to buy into any change. Now, how we communicate with these groups of stakeholders is going to be key. And the messages that we give have got to be given in a way that is meaningful to them. And the one thing that is for certain is that the majority of people will think very differently to yourself. And if we want to be an agent for change and to motivate other people, then we have to exhibit the maximum degree of flexibility in the way that we can communicate. Now, what I'd like to do in this section of why should anyone want to be led by you is to look at the aspects of enabling you to create rapport, trust, and openness with people within the finance team and people that interface with it. And to do this, I am going to ask you the question that in any conversation, who is responsible for the outcome from that conversation? If it's you with another person, does the responsibility lie 50-50 between you and the other person? Or is it weighted differently? And the underlying assumption of what I'm going to tell you is that you have the power and control to not only take responsibility for the outcome, but also to take responsibility for how they respond to the changes that you're suggesting to them. Because if we work on this assumption, this gives you 100% of the control. So to enable us to take full responsibility, we have to have the ability to communicate at all different levels. And this is what I'm going to be showing you how to do next. So in preparing this relationship to ensure that people want to be led by you, there's four key criteria. Number one is rapport. Secondly is state of mind. Thirdly are the language patterns that you use. And fourthly is the body language. Most of what we communicate is at an unconscious level. And it's the unconscious mind picking up the signals and the clues of why it should trust you. And trust is key in managing change and uncertainty, isn't it? So the first thing that we need to be consciously aware of is our body language and watching and observing the other person to ensure that we can match and mirror, i.e. we can copy different aspects of their body language, from the posture to their facial expressions to the quickness of the breath. And these are all things to watch for. The second that we can match and mirror are the language patterns, because 40% of the population are visual. 20% show a preference towards auditory information, and 40% are kinesthetic. What something feels like to them to enable them to get to grips is essential to them to know that your change is going to make sense. So looking at the way that we sound and the way that we construct our language patterns is key to the unconscious mind knowing that it can trust your suggestions and to motivate it to want to change. Visual, auditory, and kinesthetic language. Visual language patterns are patterns that enable the mind to construct a picture. And if somebody says to you, "I just don't see what you're saying," what they're asking for is more visual information. In fact, it might be easier to show them a picture and to draw a process map of how the change is going to look so they can take a perspective on it. Auditory language patterns give the unconscious mind the sound that they can really hear what it is that you want to say. And kinesthetic language enable people to get to grips and get a real handle on what it is that you're suggesting to them. Okay, the third is state of mind. If you want people to be motivated and inspired to want to make changes in finance, then you have to be that role model. You are probably the most important aspect of any change process. Because we know, don't we, people that we've been inspired by are usually energetic, enthusiastic, and inspiring to be around. So we have to be conscious of the way that we're presenting ourselves to other people, and having that positive state of mind is key. The fourth aspect on building rapport is to show the other person that in some way you are like them. And one very powerful way of doing this is to listen and to paraphrase back. And what I mean by paraphrasing is literally reading back the words and the way that the words have been presented back to the person that originally spoke them. What the unconscious mind picks up is that you are using the same words as them. In fact, you are on their wavelength. In fact, you are somebody very much that they can trust. So paraphrasing is an extremely useful technique in enabling somebody to answer the question, why should they be led by you? Now, moving on to the second part of this podcast, the second stage is constructing a compelling story for change, because people want to know, why should I? Why should I bother implementing changes? What's in it for me? And the compelling story for change enables them to answer many of those questions. Now, the first step in constructing this compelling story for change is to think big picture. And we have to be able to align, how does this change contribute towards what the business or the organization is trying to deliver? There has to be a very specific and measurable link and measure so people can see, how am I making a difference? Because most finance professionals, what really makes them tick is knowing that they're adding value and they're making a difference to people's lives. So in this compelling story, whether we draw it as a picture or whether we write it as a business case, people have to be able to see and get a feel for the specific changes and how they're going to contribute towards the bigger picture. The second thing with this compelling story is that there has to be very clear targets of what the change looks like when it's been implemented, i.e. what are the measures of success? How will people know when they've been successful on this change? Think about it. Most organisations implement change after change after change, and how many of those celebrate when change has been successfully implemented? If people don't know when something has been successful, it's almost as though they're on this continual process of being asked to do more and more and more. So my second suggestion, my second tip, definable, quantifiable measures and targets for change success and critical success factors. The third step is that, particularly in finance functions, we are trained to want to be in control of our organisations. One of the primary functions of finance teams is to exert control and compliance. And therefore, we want to know that something makes sense. And most people in finance, to know that something makes sense, they have to see a rational, structured, logical plan. And this is the change implementation plan. How long is it going to take? And what does that look like? And how do I fit into that plan? And this has a double whammy benefit. It minimises the risk that change won't be successful. And secondly, it enables people to know specifically what's expected of them and what it's going to mean to them over the forthcoming period. Okay, so if we really want to define in this compelling story of change what the benefits are, another technique which I'd like to introduce you to is benefits definition, because the change in itself does not deliver anything. It's the business benefits that will really make a difference. And when you look at organisational change, benefits can come in three categories. They can enable the business to do new things. They can enable the business to do things better, and they can thirdly enable the business to stop doing some things. Now, just to give you a real life example of this, most of you have shopped in a supermarket and been through the checkout. Now, when I was a girl, when I used to go down to the supermarket, there was always a lady in an overall on her knees with a ticket machine pricing up all the tins of baked beans. And you used to hear the noise as she was putting on all the tickets onto the tins of baked beans. Now, it's all automated. And as you go through the checkout, something very sophisticated is happening. Because as that tin of beans goes through the checkout and the barcode is read, it updates the sales system to let the system know that there's been a sale. It also updates the inventory system, the stock system, and it also sends a message to order a brand new tin of beans. At the same time, those checkouts are banking machines, financial services giving us cash back. And most supermarkets now, in this experience of going through the checkout, also captures all the marketing information on what every customer bought, when they bought it, how they paid for it, and what promotions and offers they took up, namely the club cards and the customer cards, the loyalty cards. So from this change of just simply changing the checkouts, what can supermarkets now do that's new? Well, they can offer cash back. They can now gather detailed marketing information. And thirdly, it's less about cash and more about electronic payments. And the beauty with electronic payments is that it's better cash flow management, isn't it? And also the introduction of just-in-time. So what they can do that's new, and you will have seen this, is that supermarkets now don't have warehouses. In fact, they've opened up that floor space to sell us what? Clothes, electrical. So when we go into supermarkets, we're not just buying our food, we're buying all our non-food items as well. Fantastic idea, isn't it? So those are the new things. What can they do better? Well, because they can track when customers are coming in and what they're actually buying and in what volumes, what they can do better is their resource management. So how many checkouts to open at which specific times in the week or day. And the second thing is also to reduce the queues to customers. Some supermarkets have a policy that only a couple of customers have to be queuing before they will open up another checkout. So that's keeping customers, hopefully, a lot happier, and the supermarkets are hoping a lot more loyal to them. The stop doing things. Well, if you're managing less cash, it means that you can stop spending as much money on security. It means that you can stop investing as much money in your inventory. It means you can stop wasting obsolete stock, and you can stop, to a large extent, having a warehouse. So you see how we're building this compelling story for change. Because if I told you 10 years ago, if I could show you a way, an attractive way, in which you could make customers happier and save money and be able to upsell and cross-sell, do you think supermarkets would have wanted to have spoken to me? And do you think that the people who work in supermarkets would be interested in seeing and also feeling how they could be part of a successful organisation? Okay, the third part of this podcast is managing people through uncertainty. And what I would like to do is to give you an insight into how the majority of people working in finance want to feel in control. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the way that the human mind works, because it is a control machine. It has been designed over time to effectively take chaos and unstructured information and to filter it so we can make sense of it, so we can take control of our external environment, so we can get the best results possible. And the problem comes in organisations where people are uncertain, where they find it difficult to rationalise what they're being impacted by. So what we need to do as finance managers is to enable finance professionals and finance teams to make sense of changes. Yes, we've talked about the compelling story for change, but sometimes people need to do that on a personal level. And as finance managers, you know, don't you, that there's never going to be a time of 100% accuracy, of 100% completeness when we're talking about the future, because the future hasn't happened. The future carries with it risks. And when we're talking about making changes that affect people's roles and responsibilities, that affects their career prospects, that perhaps affects their career security and their job security, then that's when change becomes difficult. And my observation is that when change is clear and when change can be defined, people can cope with that. When the future is uncertain, this leads to worrying. And our job as finance professionals and finance managers is to help minimise the impact of worry. Our job is to enable people to take care of what it is that's within their control. And worrying, the Greek definition of worrying, is the divided mind, i.e. worrying about what is not within their control. It's almost like a stream of thought pulling us in different directions. And why does the human mind do this? It believes that it is a mechanism to keep us safe. What I'm going to be suggesting is how you can enable people to think consciously and to look at the different scenarios and the issues that concern them, but to be able to go to the third step of trying to create a solution or a defined risk to them that they can take steps towards to be in control and to minimise that personal risk. The first strategy to move people from the situation of feeling out of influence to into influence and control is to reduce the time horizon. The longer we make the time horizon, the further into the future we're actually going, and the further into the future we go, the higher the degree of uncertainty. So rather than worrying about what's going to happen in 12 months' time, let's refocus people on what they can be certain of and what they can be in control of this week or this month or even just today, if that's what's required. The second, to enable people to be in control and to manage uncertainty, is to give them the assumptions. What shall we assume about the future to enable us to make sense of it? And as accountants, we are trained, aren't we, to manage risk and to use different scenarios and to work with assumptions. And really, the only thing that we're doing here is using our professional skill for personal advantage. And that's a good thing. So the challenge for us as finance professionals is not only anticipating the reaction and the responses from groups of stakeholders, but also to anticipate the response of individuals. Now, why would we want to do that? Because as managers, we are responsible for the productivity, the outcomes from organisations. And as individuals go through the change process, this can affect their ability to produce results. For example, an individual traditionally, as change is announced and change is impacted on them, can go from the emotional state of being in surprise to rejecting that the change is ever going to come along and that there's a process of denial, to false recovery, thinking, well, we've been here before and change has impacted us, and if I keep my head down, then really it won't affect me, to feeling the emotions of loss and anger. and then hopefully moving on into exploration and finally commitment to engage in the changes. And for us as managers, we need to enable people to move through this different spectrum of emotions so they can feel as though that they can make a difference and feel in control of what's impacting them on a very personal level. So who is responsible for the responses of your key stakeholders to the changes that you're suggesting to them? Who is responsible for their response? And for us as finance professionals, if we're going to get the best results from our finance teams, we have to take responsibility for their response. And as we're planning change, to build into our implementation plans the human element that enables people to be listened to be acknowledged, and for them to move through that emotional process that they need to go through. As finance professionals, this is something that comes new to many of us. And when I talk to finance professionals, the things that worry them or the things that concern them when they go home is not usually to do with a change in a spreadsheet or a change in a system. It's usually down to a conversation that they've had with somebody from their finance teams. So as a professional, if we can learn more about how to enable people to engage with change and to take control of uncertainty, then that's going to help us in our personal career and to enable us to prove that we can deliver exceptional results. So the three sections of this podcast, why should anybody be led by you? Creating a compelling story for change and managing people through uncertainty, I hope has given you an insight into some changes that you can make. My name is Amanda Morehouse. Thank you very much for listening to this AAT podcast on managing finance teams through change and uncertainty.